Hello and welcome to Unusual Sources. This is Peter Leibovich along with Brendan Stone on 93.3. This is on Christmas Eve. We have a special guest all the way halfway around the world and to the south of us, someone who has an important story to be told that I don't think has ever been told until recently here in Canada. On the line is Terry Pickard from Australia, who's written a book called Combat Medic. Terry, are you there?
Yes, I am, Peter. How are you this morning?
I'm well this evening. I know it's morning in Australia. How is it there in Australia right now?
Peter, it's Christmas Day here, and it's a very, very warm day in Brisbane, Australia. A little overcast, and we'll probably get a little bit of rain later. But I'd like to wish all your listeners a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, and yourself as well.
Oh, thank you very much, and thank you for taking time on... I forgot that it's Christmas Day in Australia. It's just Christmas Eve here in the evening. Terry, this program has followed many events that have occurred in Africa, and particularly in Rwanda, and you've written an important book on the subject of Rwanda that deals with your own personal experience. The book name is Combat Medic, and... You were in Rwanda during the period of time where the killings occurred. Could you just give our audience a little bit of background on how you ended up in Rwanda? When the book name is Combat Medic, that means that you were a combat medic, right?
Peter, I am part of Medical Corps, and I was a medical assistant within Medical Corps, and they can be... transferred to any unit, any location, basically around the world, and Australia decided to send a contribution to the UNAMIR mission in Rwanda in 1995, and I went there as a sergeant medic, a fairly senior sort of sergeant, and went on the second rotation in 1995, Peter, just after the main genocide, Peter.
Just after the main genocide, this was after the sort of the agreement to allow the UN back in, right?
That's right, Peter. The UN had just been increased back to 5,000 plus soldiers. And, yes, it was after the main genocide in 1994, and then the Arusha Accord was put into place, and the United Nations it increased... the mission to 5,500 soldiers, United Nations soldiers.
Great. Peter. So you were a trained combat medic from the Australian Army, and which, much like Canada, well, Canada used to do a little bit more of, you were transferred under UN command, right, in Rwanda. Now, your book is about the refugee, what occurred in the refugee camp called Kibiehu, where there was over 100,000 refugees. Could you describe to the listeners how you ended up with that particular assignment, and what did this camp look like? When 100,000 people is a lot of people. So if you can describe a little bit about how you got there and what you saw when you were there, when you first got there.
Peter, as part of the Australian contingent, our particular mission was to supply medical coverage for the United Nations soldiers, and also to help out in any sort of humanitarian way that we could. I was actually transferred there in Kigali, the capital city, as the ward sergeant. So I was working in the ward, and after a period of 6 weeks, we all swapped around our jobs, and I ended up in our casualty clearing post, which is a mobile facility that can be put anywhere with you know, a limited amount of medical resources and staff at very short notice. And I was actually in the casualty clearing post, or CCP as we call them, and we got called to move to Kibeho refugee camp. On arriving there, yes, there was 100,000, probably more, probably up to 120,000, 130,000 refugees in the camp, but it looked quite deserted when we arrived because the refugees had been herded up into a ridge line as the RPA soldiers were attempting to close the camp. So they pushed all the people into the ridgeline. So as we entered the camp, we thought at first it was actually deserted because all the shelters had been burnt down and, you know, there was just no one there until we got right into the centre and there was an absolute sea of humanity, Peter.
Pushed together. There was no place to... They weren't in any huts or houses. They were just sort of just sitting there on the ridge?
Peter, they were on the ridge line, no. There was no housing or anything there because they'd been forced to leave their temporary shelters that were supplied by the United Nations, their blue tarpaulins and etc. And also food and water had been cut off at this stage. In fact, probably a couple of days prior to our arrival, to ensure that everybody remained in the same place. And in fact, Peter, it was that crowded, if you like, almost like sardines, I guess, that at one stage my vehicle took nearly half an hour only to get 100 metres further down the road. That's how compressed the people were on that ridgeline, Peter.
I know this is really, I mean, for our listeners, this is an important story, and this is going to be, and it's going to be hard to tell. And I know that you've gone through great strain and since this occurred, but it's so important to be heard. When we say 100,000 or more refugees, we're talking about men, women, and children, right? These are not just single men. These are whole families.
Peter, yes, that's correct. There were men, women, children of all ages. There were even women with their babies being carried on their back in the typical African sort of style. But they were starting to get sort of separated in the crowd and, you know, people were losing family members. I can't find so-and-so. So it was a fairly desperate situation and that was by the time we got there. On the 18th of April, you know, things were getting pretty tense and pretty desperate, remembering again that they've had no food and water. It has been cut off a couple of days previously already there, Peter.
So how were they? They had nothing to eat? I guess they were on the point of verge of starvation?
That's correct, Peter. It got to such a desperate survival situation that, as described in my book, Combat Medic, which is published by Big Sky Publishing in Australia, it got to the stage where mothers were actually removing the corn from human feces and actually re-cooking that corn to feed to their children. Some of the children themselves were actually removing corn from human waste and just eating it as it was. That's how desperate things were getting there, Peter.
Now, the RPF was in charge of this camp. What did they tell you? Did they explain to you why they had burnt all the huts and taken away the food and herded people to the ridge?
Peter, the RPF were the government in Rwanda then, and the RPA soldiers were actually working for the government, the Rwandan Patriotic Army, were working for the government to ensure that the camp was closed. There were no reasons given. Nobody actually explained to us why they did things the way they did, but what they were trying to achieve in the world's eyes was the continuing practice of a thing called Operation Retour, where the Rwandans were given the choice of being able to remove themselves from the camps and be sent back to their own communes, villages or whatever, by truck or whatever, so that the camp could eventually be closed and the world would see that the Rwandan government and the RPA soldiers were actually achieving an objective that was sort of set between themselves and the United Nations, Peter.
And that was their political objective. And by the way, the RPF is still in the government of Rwanda as we speak today. But as you saw this massive humanity on the ridge, and if the ostensibly the situation was to get people to resettle, Did they have trucks, or did they? What was the mechanism they were going to use to resettle these people? Just get them to walk out of the camp?
Peter, it was a sort of combined effort between United Nations, all facilities, including non-government organisations, the United Nations soldiers, to work in conjunction with the RPF government and also the RPA soldiers who were on the ground in Cabello, to actually move these people through a checkpoint so they could be registered or checked or whatever. And then they were hopefully to be placed on trucks, which were supplied by various non-government organisations and United Nations soldiers, etc., to have those people actually transported to back to their communes. Yes, Peter.
But that didn't occur. What occurred, of course, is what you write in your book. You said that the commanding officer told you to expect gunfire.
Peter, yes, that was told to us by my officer commanding. He was an infantry officer in charge of us, the team that went to Cabello. It would have to be remembered that, it was basically suggested that the Rwandan government was in favour of UNAMIR 2. However, one of the things that was occurring was that the RPF and obviously the RPA, who were the army working for the RPF, weren't too keen on the United Nations intervention within their own country. And if I could just quote one thing here, I quote, "The time for UN intervention is past. The genocide is almost over. Most of potential victims have been killed. The RPF hereby declares that it is categorically opposed to the proposed United Nations intervention and will not under any circumstances cooperate in its setting up of the operation." And that was quoted by Gerald Gahami and Claude Desaidi of the RPF political office at the time. And they went on to say, "Should the UN force come between the two warring sides, then it will be treated as an enemy force and will be engaged." So we faced a problem where if gunfire was heard or we saw things that weren't quite right, we really weren't allowed to intervene because we would be then classed as an enemy and they could thus engage us. So we had to be very, very careful in what we were doing at the time there, Peter.
So your life was at risk during this period of time. Any UN soldier there's life was at risk.
That's correct, Peter. The risk was, assessed, and they obviously needed a medical team down there, and Australia's role was to provide medical support. So, yes, we went down there, and yes, our lives were at risk. As we continue the interview, you will find out. Yes, please, Peter.
So, from the time you got there, within 24, you saw all this happening within the first 24 hours, where the people were forced up on the ridge. There was supposed to be a clearing situation where, you know, they would come through a checkpoint, but something went very, very well. Either went very wrong, or another plan was in play, because it didn't go in that manner. It didn't. It wasn't. Gunfire started breaking out in the camp, right?
That's correct, Peter. What was happening was within the camp itself and in amongst the refugees were suspects from the previous year's major genocide, where up to nearly 1 million people were unfortunately slaughtered. So the RPA were sort of herding people through the checkpoint, and anybody they thought may be a suspect, they would pluck them out and take them away for questioning. Obviously, some of them didn't return. However, Peter, as the days started to progress, the urgency to get this camp closed and get these people through the checkpoint was becoming stronger and stronger, And the Interahamwe, the perpetrators of the very large genocide of 94, were starting to attack people within the refugees. In fact, attacking the refugees, firing shots, stirring them up, making them do things, rushing the crowd, just so that they would be able to hide in amongst the crowd and hopefully slip through the cordon of the RPA. But as the days started to progress, it gradually got worse and worse. And as a casualty clearing post, we were getting more and more casualties with absolutely horrendous wounds. Peter, go on.
So, I mean, these wounds were men, women and children coming in?
That's correct, Peter. There was old men, women, children, pregnant ladies, even babies. Some had unfortunately been killed, and some were horrifically wounded with gunshot wounds, machete wounds, knife wounds, wounds of all description that you wouldn't actually even get to see in a whole career working in a hospital, I don't think, Peter. And this is before the actual the larger part of the massacre occurred. This is in the previous 2 days before what is now known as the Cabello Massacre actually occurred, Peter.
And can you describe to our listeners what occurred in that period of time? So, I mean, you say for 2 days there was firing, there was fighting, and I'm assuming from both sides, from the Interahamwe side and from the RPF side, right, shooting into the crowd?
Peter, the RPA soldiers on the ground, I guess, who are RPF,
yeah.
Were actually getting some sniper fire from Interahamwe, but the Interahamwe were deliberately injuring and killing refugees and telling the refugees, if you leave this camp, you will be killed. So there's fear going back and forth and back and forth amongst the crowd, and the crowd is in a absolute, getting into a bit of a frenzy, and you know, I mean, seeing their own people, helpless men, women, children, babies even, being either hurt or killed. And obviously the RPA at the time needed to try and control this situation, but I think them in controlling the situation, it actually got completely out of hand, and then what occurred was what we know as the Cabello Massacre. This was going on up until the 22nd of April when the actual Cabello Massacre occurred itself.
And the Cabello Massacre, if you could describe to our listeners what you saw firsthand.
Well, once again, with a good description in my book, Combat Medic, by published by Big Sky Publishing in Australia, what happened basically is the RPA withdrew to the church at Cabello and got into a very, very altered state of consciousness, I guess, if you like, chanting and ranting and raving and going on, and then they burst out of the church, and at the same time the crowd tried to surge through the checkpoint to run across the border into Burundi or somewhere like that, and the RPA just opened fire into the crowd, Peter, and we as United Nations soldiers, and particularly us, my group as medics, could only take up defensive positions behind the available sandbag bunkers that were there and just watch for a period of, a few hours while this carried on and on and on, just the massive slaughter of up to, you know, what we estimate maybe 8 to 10,000 innocent men, women, children, babies, until it started raining, actually, and the crowd started to settle down and the firing eased away, Peter.
My God. So, and you saw this, the response of yourself and your mates, it must have been horrifying, and at the same time wanting to do something, I mean, being you were supposedly were there to try and help the civilians, right?
That's right, Peter. It's a very unfortunate situation and a very bizarre and probably a very unique situation that we found ourselves in, particularly as Australians and I guess particularly as United Nations soldiers and, you know, the infantry soldiers from Australia and particularly, again, from a medic point of view, that we were unable to intervene due to, I guess, had we intervened, we would have been wiped out. There is no doubt about that. We know that for a fact because of what was previously quoted about, you know, we would be engaged if we intervened in any way. And, Peter, you're looking at 32 Australian soldiers, seven of which were medics. We're non-combatants, medics, I mean, goodness me. And then there's over 2,000 RPA soldiers. We wouldn't have stood a chance, Peter. And the mere fact that we were there has probably saved not only our lives by not intervening, but also the 60 or 70-odd thousand refugees that did survive weren't actually wiped out, because it could have just turned completely nasty. The RPA could have just wiped out everybody in the whole camp, and the world would have been none the wiser, Peter.
Yeah, I mean, when you say none the wiser, this story in itself is, people knew about the Kabeya massacre, but not in this way, not in this manner, not until you wrote this book. You said you figured about 8,000 people were killed in that few hour period. I know that your unit tried to keep count of what was happening in order to be able to report it.
Yes.
And you witnessed yourself how many with your unit that you could accurately say that you saw that were being killed.
All right, Peter. The day of the massacre was the 22nd of April. We didn't stay in camp that night. We were able to get out, and we had to escort all the non-government people out as well. It was not a safe place to be at all. And the next morning we returned, and what we did, two of the Special Forces soldiers, we call them SAS, or the Special Air Service Regiment soldiers from Australia, actually did a body count using what we call a pace counter. And a pace counter is just a navigation guide to count how many paces you walk when you navigate in the bush and things. And what they did is, with half a section of infantry each, they walked up each side of the road and just clicked everybody. One click for every dead body they found. They reached between them 4,050. They were stopped from counting because the RPA soldiers realised what they were doing. Now, it must be also remembered, Peter, that during the night when we weren't there, that the RPA had been removing bodies as fast as they can and taking them to areas where the United Nations soldiers were restricted from. So we figure, we've got an accurate figure of 4,050. We estimate out in the field laying on the ground that hadn't been counted would make up to about 8,000. One CNN reporter estimated that it could have possibly have been even 25,000 by the time the RPA had removed bodies during the night and et cetera like that, Peter. That's how we did that.
Now, in your book, you describe a couple of scenes that you saw that you yourself saw. I mean, you saw a lot, but a specific scene with an old woman in an RPA soldier.
That's correct, yes. I've described in my book, Combat Medic, that what happened was an old lady, this is during the period of time when the massacre of the larger amount of people was occurring, an old lady just 50 metres to our left and down the ridgeline a bit, put her hands up in surrender, basically. And an RPA soldier saw her and actually went down and got her and escorted her back up to the top of the hill. And I was talking to my good friend Corporal Paul Jordan. He was one of the special service soldiers there, special air service soldiers there with me. And the RPA soldier, once he got to the road, Peter, he turned around, looked at us directly in the eye, smiled at us, then pushed her to the ground and shot her in the back. And it was a definite, deliberate attempt to make us retaliate in some way so that the RPA would have reason to fire upon us. And it would have, it took all our strength, and especially Paul's, because he's a very very professional SAS, Special Forces soldier, all our strength not to actually move from where we were and not to retaliate. And it was a terrible thing to see, Peter, go.
Now, after seeing that and after taking the number, did your unit report what happened to your superior officers? And what was the reaction up the line? So what did your superior...
Okay, Peter. Yes, we were in radio contact with our headquarters at all times. They could not get anybody in to extract us out because it was a hot zone, if you like. The Americans like the word hot zone.
Yeah.
It was too dangerous to send in anybody, and it was too far. It was like 150 kilometres. You can't just send in an APC. It's going to take 10 hours anyway, you know. So we were stuck there, Peter, and yes, we did. Our superiors knew well what was going on, but could do nothing but sit by and listen and advise. And of course, the next day when the press turned up, briefly, CNN and people like that, some of our Australian soldiers were actually interviewed and suggested, well, we've got a definite body count of 4,050, and you could probably double that for the people that are laying out the fields, maybe twice as many as that. And instantly, within an hour, the news has quickly spread out into the wider community of the world. The RPF government has panicked, I guess, and actually shut down all communications to the outside world for 3 days to minimise the damage, if you like. And if I quote the Rwandan President Buzimugu at the time, he went on TV and he said, the figures that have been given have been exaggerated by the Australians. There are only 300 dead. And that's what he was quoted as saying. And a sticky situation again, Peter. We needed to stay in country a further 5 months to continue our mission and support the United Nations and, you know, the local people and that. So we basically told to, or not told to, but I guess we had to pull our heads in and just sort of keep it a bit quiet and just let it run its course, I guess, Peter.
Yes, because, I mean, up to that time, that government had sort of goodwill coming out of the Civil War, right? It was this kind of event would have been shocking to the rest of the world from this particular government. But you had reported it. The government had denied it or, you know, basically, you know, kept it shut. But after, was there ever an inquiry into it? What happened to the eyewitness, I mean, yourself and the other eyewitnesses? Did you complain to your own army, your own government about nothing being done about it? What was the reaction?
Peter, we passed on the information as you always do, and whatever response or actions that happen isn't really our responsibility. Obviously, it comes from higher, maybe UN command or whatever. But if I can just read a little bit out of a magazine that we have in Australia that was published near the time, the UN did what it always does. It sat on its hands and announced an investigation, the result of which was indecisive. The Tutsi government were not criticised for their actions, and pressure was placed on the Australian Medical Support Force to shut up from both the United Nations and the Australian government. The Australian command in Rwanda was in a sticky situation. We had to stay there further 5 months, and a workable relationship with the RPA and RPF was essential to that reality and for the soft safety of the soldiers, sailors, airmen under their command. So we rolled with the flow. Unquote, if you like. Peter.
Wow. Now, I'd like to talk about what happened to you personally. I mean, you saw something that would shock any normal human being, and obviously you saw the truth. The truth wasn't allowed. Your government, the people that you were working for didn't let this truth come out. So how did you personally react to it?
Well, I think, Peter, my personal reaction upon returning to Kigali, which was where our headquarters was and we were based, the first thing I did was have two beers. Typical Australian. Sorry right. about that. But
you share that
we
with
were still
Canadians.
In country of first. Yeah, okay. The typical, I guess, what happened was as the 5 months progressed and we continued on with our mission and that, I guess the news started to fade and, the government got on with its business and Rwanda was eventually, Kibeho camp was eventually closed without any further incident after that. And I guess it just sort of faded into the background and everything seemed all right, but I was already at that time, in fact 2 weeks after the Kibeho tragedy, starting to suffer some terrible nightmares and things. And, being a medical person, I am aware of post-traumatic stress. The Australian Army sent a psychological team over to help us and things like that. And we sort of ended up finishing the mission and coming back to Australia. And it just seemed to have, faded away, it was sort of just swept under the carpet or... nobody's really knows about it, that sort of attitude, Peter.
Right. But when you came back to Australia, it didn't go away from you, right?
No, Peter, and it's still with me, as you could well imagine. And one of your famous generals, General Dallaire, who now is a senator, has had the same sort of post-traumatic stress reaction that I've had. But from my point of view, Peter, I was discharged a year later from the Australian Army, terribly sick, with post-traumatic stress. I was having horrific nightmares that I couldn't do anything about. Flashbacks nearly every day. I could hardly work. It was terrible, a terrible, terrible thing, and it still is. Although I'm in much better control of it now, I've spent quite a deal of time having to relearn how to live life, in a special clinic that deals with mental illnesses, so plus medication and things like that. So I've actually managed to get on a bit, but one of the most important things I've managed to do is actually remove some of the guilt and horror from my mind and actually place it into this book. And it's the book Combat Medic, published by Big Sky Publishing in Australia here, has gone a long way to help me in my own treatment, if you like, by getting rid of some of that horrible guilt of not being able to help those poor refugees and the injuries that I saw and the treatments I had to do, and I'll let you step in there.
Yeah, no, no, that is important. You writing this book, Combat Medic, you shine a light on something that that hasn't been talked about in order to understand the situation in Rwanda. People, you know, want simple solutions to very complicated problems, and I guess there's no innocence in this, but the fact is that 4,000 people are killed that we know factually were killed, and probably twice as much more, and nothing is done. That's a crime. In normal criminal justice system, if you murder somebody 30 years ago, you still can be charged 30 years after the fact. And that's one person, never mind 8,000 people. And the fact that you wrote this book, you know, gives people, you know, an eyewitness account. I would urge everybody to get a copy of this book. When did you write it, Terry? When did you decide to write? When did you first start writing it, and when did it get published?
Peter, what I did was I decided to record everything in my diaries onto a computer so that if anything like a house fire or something occurred, at least I'd have some copy of my diaries. And as I was progressing, I was going further and further into the diaries, and I decided maybe I could chapterize this and make a little bit of a story. And it sort of progressed from there, and I guess the next thing I knew, I sort of had a fairly decent personal account of something that the world has probably never even heard about, and something that is personal but also beneficial in some way. So I sent it to the publisher, Big Sky Publishing, and Danny Neves and his team, and they took it on board straight away, Peter. Within 3 months, it was on the shelf, and I'll tell you now, Peter, it's only been on the shelf 16 weeks, and it is creating quite some interest, and I'm glad to see that, because I want people to know what happened in Kibayo, and I want people to know what happened to the ordinary soldier who was serving there and couldn't do anything. And I'm very, very pleased. A couple of days ago, I was reading in our newspaper here in Brisbane, Australia, that the three people who have actually been tried and sentenced for the main genocide. So I guess the purpose for my book is, one, get the story out there that has never been told, and honestly, and with no exaggerations or anything. Secondly, a little bit of mind relief for myself. And thirdly, I want to help the soldiers that are quite ill that served with me. By having that story out there, they can read it and say, oh, God, I'm not the only one, or something like that. And I do believe I may have achieved all three of those goals, Peter.
Well, you've gone a long way to achieve those goals. And maybe at the same time, you might, maybe through this book, maybe some of the perpetrators of some of these other crimes that haven't been charged yet, because you know, the problem with the world with justice, that it sometimes only goes to the victors, because the people that were responsible for what happened at Kibayo should not be allowed to just walk freely and do whatever they do every day. Maybe this book will help open that door. And so I want to thank you for being on the program and remind our listeners, the book is called Combat Medic, and it's published Big Sky Publishing. Now, in order to order it from Canada, you can order it on bigskypublishing.com.au. Right, Terry?
That's right, Peter. And, it'll be sent directly over there. Not a problem.
Yes. I don't know if it's on bookshelves yet here in this country, but we'll look into that. But I urge everybody to go to Big Sky Publishing, just like you hear, B-I-G-S-K-Y. publishing.com.au, and you'll be able to get a hold of Terry Pickard's Combat Medic. Terry, thank you very much for being on this program. I know it's it must be hard on Christmas Day to tell this tale again, but maybe this is the day for the tale to be told.
I think every day for me, Peter, is the day to to tell the tale and get that story out there, and hopefully the perpetrators will eventually come to justice. And Peter, I wish once again all your listeners and yourself a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and I sincerely hope it's not too cold there, Peter.
No, not today. Today it's raining. It's just flooding, that's all. Okay, take care.
Okay.
Merry Christmas.
All right, thank you, Peter.
Bye. That was Terry Pickard from Australia, author of Combat Medic. We'll just take a quick break, and we'll get back to you.